Good morning. This is Keep 106.
You are listening to Ridgeway Magazine with John Shepherd and Andy Fenton.
Just a little loving early in the morning beats a cup of coffee for starting off the day. Just a little loving when the world is yawning makes you wake up feeling good, things are coming your way.
Hello, and in the show today we ask, how's business in Tier 2 Weymouth? We focus on a local charity for young people called Steps, and we visit a community shop that sells top quality food at rock bottom prices to those in need and in food poverty. On the domestic front, we have tips on how to get rid of limescale in Dorset's hard water area.
And we go to Portland once more, this time to hear why the idea of allowing camper vans to park overnight is meeting opposition. Our tame vet recalls it's all in a Christmas day's work for a vet, and he advises against treating our pets too well at Christmas. But we start with this warning from the Metropolitan Police for job seekers at this difficult time. Of all the nastiest scams doing the rounds at the moment, this one has to be near the top of the list. You may not have heard of it, but it goes under the heading of recruitment fraud. And given that so many have lost their jobs, a figure increased by the failure of the Arcadia group of shops and the demise of Debenhams, job hopefuls, both nationally and locally, are being preyed upon by bogus recruitment agencies that are offering positions that do not exist. The scam is probably happening right here in our part of Dorset, even as we speak. So, how does it work, and why has it become necessary for the Metropolitan Police to set up a not-for-profit organisation called Safer Jobs? That's S-A-F-E-R. The scam comes at a time when the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, has warned unemployment could rise from 1.6 million now to 2.6 million in a year's time. The tricksters con job seekers into a menu of fraudulent opportunities to gain employment, but basically the purpose is to rip off the unsuspecting. As with most scams, it starts off with harvesting personal information like details of work experience, personal finance, credit card and bank details. They may also require a copy of your passport or even the document itself to verify your details used, they say, to enable you to go for a job which they say will suit you. It all sounds all too plausible. There are many permutations to the fraud. The scammers place advertisements for fake jobs among genuine recruitment ads on a variety of platforms. Respondents are then advised they might need more qualifications and special courses are available to bring them up to speed with job requirements. Criminal record checks and advice on how to improve a CV is offered.
Now, all these come at a price. £500 for an enhanced CV that might show bogus qualifications from colleges and universities, some real and some imaginary, but they all look to be genuine. £50 is going to the going rate to access a fake site offering a disclosure and barring service, that's DBS, criminal check. Now, there might be signing up fees running into hundreds of pounds for career advice and presentation coaching, which never ever materialise. Bogus recruitment agencies are using applicants' personal information to arrange fake interviews for jobs that sound real in return for a signing-on fee. A payment which no legitimate job agency would ever charge, this fee might range from £100 to £500, depending on the seniority of the job on offer. These days, as the Safer Jobs organisation told Ridgeway magazine, fake interviews are even easier to arrange. Until the COVID lockdown and travel restrictions, job interviews were nearly always face-to-face with the employer, or in the case of senior appointments, a professional headhunter might be involved as well. Since March, interviews have had to be done or held over the phone and by video link. This helps the fraudsters and provides them with an excuse if the link they arrange, which of course is bogus anyway, fails to materialise. All sorts of excuses will be given, but by the time the penny has dropped, the scammer will have been long gone. There have been cases where fraudsters have used people with good, plausible telephone manner to become recruiters without realising that they, themselves, have become an essential part of the recruitment fraud. These people would have answered an advertisement offering work in the recruitment business. They will believe they have a real job that will pay a generous salary after a probation period. They would be told that they were working remotely for a genuine recruitment company, given a company email account and a list of genuine job hopefuls to contact for positions that sound real.
These hopefuls would be interviewed by phone and might be told they needed to improve their CVs by taking courses at a cost of several hundred pounds, which would result in professional qualifications or professional certification. Such qualifications from the dozens of awarding bodies, faked or real, are vital to many applicants' presentations for a job where degrees and diplomas are required. And of course, the bogus recruitment company would be only too happy to provide shortcuts to professional qualifications. A certificate might result at the end of a course, but the course itself is a fake and or shortened version of the real thing, and therefore only too easy to complete. The unwitting recruiter was involved simply to sell the course and would be dropped after a few weeks without any of the agreed wages being paid. With so many desperately seeking work, how do you separate the fake job from the real deal? The Daily Mail recently published a guide with some helpful tips. The first is to check the genuine nature of the job itself by verifying the company offering it. You can check details and status of a business with Companies House to find out if it really exists. This service is free. Just log on to the Companies House website and turn detective. The information will show the company address, the name of the directors, and if it's still operating or has ceased trading. This last point is important, as scammers will adopt the name of companies recently closed. Check that the salary offered is not too good and the qualifications required too low.
As always with fake websites, platforms and emails offering jobs, check for poor grammar and spelling mistakes. Never assume a job is genuine just because it's on an established platform. Many scams are international and created by fraudsters whose first language is not English. Don't pay upfront charges for interviews and check that any courses recommended are for genuine qualifications required by an employee from a genuine awarding body. View with scepticism courses offered by colleges and universities and that they really do exist. Check particularly those colleges that are overseas, the United States especially. As always, do not readily volunteer personal information, credit card details, and never, ever send your passport to anyone. You'll never get it back. For further information and advice, and to report recruitment fraudsters, contact Safer Jobs at safejobs.com.
Keep in touch with local issues and local views with Ridgeway Magazine on Keep 106.
It's now a week since shops have been allowed to open, although the hospitality trade is still suffering under burdensome restrictions. Take a small town like Weymouth. How is business? John asked Chief Executive Officer Claudia Webb from the town's Business Improvement District.
Claudia, how is Weymouth doing in the light of the de-restriction of shopping?
I think Weymouth is doing as well as it can be at the moment. Obviously, things are still a little bit difficult because we're in Tier 2, but lots of places have reopened, and I think retail especially is doing well. However, when it comes to hospitality, the rules are making it slightly more difficult for places to open and be successful. So a lot of places have chosen not to reopen for the time being.
I suppose it must be pretty much impossible for them to open and be profitable.
Yeah, it can be, especially if it's quite a small venue and people have to buy food in order to stay in there.
Exactly.
So it doesn't seem worth the bother for a lot of business owners, unfortunately. But hopefully we'll get our tier change later in the month. That's the hope, anyway. And, you know, in the meantime, we're attracting people into the town. The council are offering free parking on Saturdays. And, you know, shops are able to extend their opening hours if they choose to, although I haven't actually heard of any specific ones doing so yet. And we had Small Business Saturday at the weekend. And town was quite busy. There was music in the town, the decorations were up, so the atmosphere was generally quite good.
Right. What about shop closures? I mean, you know, we're all frightened of what's going to happen to Debenhams, but how are other shops faring? I mean, it was in the last few weeks, have more closed, or is there a case where some are opening?
I think it's mostly the bigger, the chain stores that are closing. And Weymouth has always been very supportive of independent shops, and we have a majority of independent shops, in fact, which is the opposite to the majority of the country. So, and we've been obviously encouraging people, and so have everyone else, to support local this Christmas and going forward, because now's the time that they really need our support. And you know, there's been quite a few shops opening during the lockdown and since the lockdown, so that's quite a positive sign.
Can you think of any type of shop that's opened?
We've got a new furniture upholstery shop called House of Gumption by the bridge. We've got some new hairdressers. There's a new barber shop opening, I believe. The Southwest Coast Refill shop has moved to a bigger premises, which is great news. And, people are really being quite... they're all very much using their initiative to change their businesses in order to make them successful during these difficult times.
So I suppose the message is that there's life in the old town yet.
Yeah, we just have to adapt, unfortunately, which is always hard to do, especially at such a worrying time. But, you know, retail is changing and we have to adapt to it.
And, of course, you are about to leave Weymouth BID, aren't you, for Pastors New?
So yes, at the end of December.
Right, and you've appointed somebody new, haven't you, to take your place. Who is it?
Her name is Dawn Rondo, and she previously ran her own business advice service, and she's had other roles as well, which have provided her with a lot of information and skills, and I think she'll be great at the role.
Well, we will look forward to talking to her when she takes up her appointment.
And that was Claudia Webb from the Weymouth BID, and we wish her well for the future. Now, every week we take a look at a local charity and suggest it is worthy of your generous support. Well, in this edition of Ridgeway Magazine, we invite Tom Lane of Steps, a youth charity, to talk about its work.
Tom Lane, tell me, Steps, it's more than just a youth club, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Hi, John, and thanks very much for inviting me to have a chat with you about Steps, the youth club and charity. I suppose it depends a bit what people's view of a modern youth centre is, because a lot of people perhaps think of a youth club as just somewhere where young people go and hang out with their friends, play pool and table tennis and so forth. And yes, we do have a pool and a table tennis table, but a modern youth centre does a huge amount more than that. And how I did describe the development really of youth work and youth clubs over the last sort of 50 years in very simplified terms is that 50 years ago young people would go to youth clubs and have fun. 25 years ago young people would go to youth clubs, have fun and learn something, and these days in a modern youth club like Steps, hopefully young people would come and have fun, learn something and achieve something as well. And our aims are very much about young people developing skills and confidence which enable them then to make positive choices in their lives and healthy choices.
Now, you say that you offer support. So can we just sort of be a little bit more expansive about what sort of support you offer and why?
Absolutely. Well, there's a range of support, and interestingly, I've been at STEPS 26 years, rather extraordinarily, and during those 26 years, the amount of time we spend supporting young people individually has grown enormously as a sort of proportion of what we do. Used to be, 26 years ago, that probably 90% of what we did was developmental group work, and probably 10% of our time was spent supporting individuals, sort of one-to-one support work. These days, it's probably more like 50-50 in terms of our time. We spend a lot more time now, you know, talking with individual young people about the problems they're facing. And that can range from very common, if you like, day-to-day problems to do with some low-level mental health issues, relationships, bullying, sexual health advice, careers advice, problems at home and school and with friends, online difficulties that they face. Those are all very sort of common issues. And then sometimes it can be more serious problems that they're facing, such as more serious mental health problems, more serious bullying, racism, and possibly drug use, maybe early unexpected pregnancies, things like that. And occasionally it can be something really quite serious, you know, such as potentially, you know, life affecting things like suicidal thoughts or abuse. Things like that. So thankfully that's not too frequent, but those things do obviously crop up from time to time. So that gives you a bit of a flavour of the kind of issues that young people face, and we give them support so that they can deal effectively with all of those things in their lives.
Now, young people are famous for bottling up issues, you know, for not communicating. So how is it that you get your young people, and let's talk about the age that people are at STEPS. What makes them open up to you?
Well, we're talking mostly about the teenage age range. The vast majority of what we do is for 13 to 19-year-olds, although we do extend up to 25 for young people with additional needs, such as learning disabilities. But most of our work is for the teenage age range. And, there's a knack that youth workers have as professional educators. We tend to have an ability to relate to young people and find little tricks and ways to get young people to open up to us. And a lot of that is really about being very honest with them, and also trying to have what we call a relationship of equality. So young people tend to be used to the majority of adults in their lives having some authority over them, power over them, whether it's parents or teachers or police that they encounter, etc. And a lot of young people experiencing problems don't react very well to that once they reach teenage. They sort of rebel against that. So we try to have a relationship of equality with young people, and also one that's, you know, based quite a lot on sort of fun and a very clear interest in them and their lives, which they appreciate. So over a period of time, as youth workers, we build relationships with young people that are professional and that are supportive, and young people feel like they can share things that are going on in their lives and get support with them.
Yes, I think another thing that you talk about on your website is opportunities. Now, what do you mean by opportunities?
What we do is we have a program. We try and have quite a structured program with different sorts of activities and opportunities. And so that can range from, you know, when young people come to STEPS, they can generally take part in a range of things over a period of time. And that would include sort of fun social activities, you know, quizzes and sports and arts and crafts and drama and music-related things. It can be sort of trips and activities outside of the club, you know, things like go-karting and dry slope skiing and tenpin bowling and those sorts of things. And then it can also lead into slightly more developmental projects. So over the years, we've had lots of young people take part in specific projects, some of which lead to accredited outcomes, so certificates and awards that they can achieve. For many years, we've run the National Youth Achievement Award. There are Dorset Awards that young people can gain. And one of the projects we set up and ran for many years was sort of nationally acclaimed, a project called Young People Doing Good, where it sort of does what it says on the tin, where we just engaged young people, for generations of young people, in projects of benefit to the community. And so that's a little flavour of the kind of developmental opportunities that we offer.
I think you told me an amazing story about one of your members who became a policeman.
That's right, and in fact there was a lovely anecdote that I'll share with you, and this gives a little insight or flavour of the long-term benefit and effect that youth work can have on young people and on our community. So we had a situation a few years ago, and obviously I won't go into the specifics, but we had a situation where a 14-year-old girl that attended the club had had some problems during the day, had fallen out with her friends, and was very upset about it. And this was noticed by one of my staff, who was an ex-club member who had come back as a volunteer, and he pointed it out to me, and we supported her during the evening, but she was still pretty upset as she left at the end of the night. And then another young person told that member of staff that this girl had said they were going to commit suicide, they were going to throw themselves off a building. And the member of staff told me, I phoned the police, the police went to where she was and managed to sort of rescue her and, you know, talk her out of doing anything to harm herself, and managed to take her home safely. And she then got support through school and other services, and is fine. And the police officer that attended was a local police officer who, again, was one of our ex-club members. So this 14-year-old girl's life was essentially saved that night by two ex-club members serving their community, one as a volunteer at Steps and one as a local police officer, which is kind of a nice story about the long-term benefits that youth work can have.
Exactly. Now, of course, youth work actually in Dorset, I believe that you are only the only one of the full-time youth clubs in the county. There's only one, there's not very many more, are there?
Not many, no. I'm not sure of the exact numbers now, but just to give your listeners an idea, unfortunately, due to you know, government cuts to local authority budgets, in 2016, Dorset County Council, as it was then, decided to stop running a youth service and stop running youth centres. Prior to that, they ran 22 youth clubs, including Steps. Some were full-time clubs like Steps, and some were part-time clubs, maybe open two or three nights a week. Anyway, so some of those centres have closed, some have been used for different purposes, including ones that are on school sites. Some have stayed as youth clubs and are now run by community groups or charities. And that's what's happened with Steps, is we've taken it over as Steps Club for Young People, the charity, and run it entirely as a charity since September 2016, which has been very tough financially. It's been very difficult. We have to do a lot of fundraising, and we're you know, very grateful for the huge amount of support that we have locally in Weymouth. I think half of Weymouth has attended Steps at some time, or had kids or grandkids that have benefited from the club. So we've got thankfully we've got a very strong reputation locally, and we have lots of local supporters, which is great. The other thing worth mentioning is that we've got an outstanding building, because the club was founded where it currently is, on Chickrell Road, in 1964. By 2008, 2009, the old club was fairly dilapidated, and the end of the last Labour government, there was a programme called My Place, nationally to develop some state-of-the-art new youth centres, and we managed to get £3 million of capital funding to build a brand new step. So the old club was demolished and the new club was built, and we opened that in April 2013. So we've got outstanding facilities. It's on two floors, main floor upstairs, with a main large club room, kitchen, offices. There's a group room upstairs that we do special projects in. Downstairs we've got a sports hall, a dance studio and an IT suite. So a fabulous facility.
So now you better tell me, whereabouts are you? And do you have a membership? I mean, how do young people get to take advantage of what you do? I mean, do they just turn up, or how do they contact you?
Yep. Well, we're on Chickrell Road. The club backs onto the marsh, so we're towards the town end of Chickrell Road, which is a very long road, but round the corner from Asda, really, opposite the Moose Lodge. And we open four evenings a week for youth work. There's a variety of groups, mostly young people based groups or groups for people with learning disabilities, that hire the club and use it during the day and after school. So the building's kind of in use morning, noon and night by all sorts of different groups. But in terms of the youth work that we run, we do four evenings a week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday and Friday evenings from 7:15 to 9:45. And it's from school year 9 up to the age of 19. And under normal circumstances, not this year, but under normal circumstances, young people can just turn up, can just come along. At the moment, we're closed due to lockdown situation, but we're hoping to reopen again soon. And when we do, we are obviously having to follow the COVID secure guidelines and have bubbles, and we can have bubbles of up to 15. So if anyone's interested in coming along, until we're past the current pandemic situation, they won't just be able to sort of turn up, because we need to have people in set bubbles. So if anybody's interested in coming along, I suggest they contact us either via our Facebook page, which is called Save Our Steps on Facebook. They can get in touch with me that way if they're interested in attending, or email us on stepsclub@yahoo.co.uk. That's stepsclub@yahoo.co.uk.
Right, Tom. Well, look, thank you very much indeed for your time. I think
thank you.
It's a wonderful opportunity for young people, and I hope that when this COVID business is over, that you will be oversubscribed.
The next item is about an organisation which helps the many families in Weymouth who are experiencing food poverty and have difficulty in putting good, wholesome food on the table. It's called The Nest, and I was mightily impressed when I called in and found a shop full of good food at mouth-wateringly low prices. People with not so long memories will remember the Waverley, pub in Albury Road, which is a large pub and it's been closed for some time now. It's become a community centre, but a community centre with a difference, because at the back of the pub is a shop called The Nest, and it's a very special shop because it is full of branded goods being sold at very, very cheap prices for people who are in need. And Eli Holland is the manager. Let's have a walk around the shop. What's the first thing we come across, Eli?
So as you come in the door, we've got bread on the right-hand side, a whole range of bread. We've got some loaves, some baguettes, some croissants, and as well as some other like pastries and baked goods, donuts and stuff. And most of that stuff's been donated by the local supermarkets. So we've got some from Lidl, Tesco, all sorts of local supermarkets. They've all been very generous in donating that. And this stuff, the items along the right-hand side, so the bread, the fruit and the veg, is all totally free. That's not included in people's items, so people can take as much of that as we have to give them, which is great.
And you've got vegetables as well, have you not? I noticed an enormously large supply of tomatoes.
Will you
tell me the bananas always go first?
Bananas go first, they're very popular. Kiwis have been surprisingly popular. I didn't peg them down as a winner, but they were. Lots of butternut squashes at the moment as well, too many of those really, but they're steadily going. As well as carrots, onions, potatoes, a kind of range. That stuff, these vegetables... week on week we'll have a different supply. We can't always promise to have bananas or potatoes, but we can always promise to have something here. So it's a nice surprise for members when they come in. They don't know what to expect, but they'll always walk away with kind of a nice bag of vegetables, which is good.
Now, before we walk around and have a look at other products on the shelves, how do people apply? You use the word members. Mm-hmm. So the food that you're selling is way below the supermarket prices. I notice that practically everything are branded goods, so there's no sort of cheap products at all. It's all branded. So how does somebody approach you?
Great, yeah. So our shop is open to members, and to become a member, people can get in touch. We have a Facebook page, we have an email address, thenestweymouth@gmail.com, and we have a phone number, 07724 285 851, and that's... I don't know if I got that right. Anyway, so people can come in and sign up as a member. So they get in touch with us through one of the avenues, and then
how do they qualify, Eli? I mean, is there a sort of qualification?
Members can qualify. There's a rough qualification, but it's not. Nothing too strict. It's just basically if you've got limited disposable income and could benefit from having a cheaper food shop, you qualify. But there's specific things that we can tick off that help. So you would automatically qualify if you receive universal credit or another income-based benefit or free school meals or are working with a debt charity. Any of those are an automatic qualification. But if you don't meet any of those criteria but could still benefit, so you might have been furloughed, all kinds of financial situations can cause people to have limited disposable income. We know that, and we know that not everybody meets one mould. So because of that, anybody who comes in and has limited disposable income, they can sit down and talk to us and give their reason, and they're likely, if they do have limited disposable income, they'll be accepted as a member.
The thing which is great is the fact that you report to me that you don't have many people who abuse the system. And I think it's because people do have to tell you about themselves, but it's not intrusive, is it?
No, not at all. In fact, sometimes we get into quite nice conversations with people. It's just a sit down with me across the table. We talk about how they're doing, how life's going for them, ask some of these questions. And it's, a good opportunity to make sure, obviously, if you were trying to cheat the system, you wouldn't sit down through that conversation. It would be awkward. It would be, you wouldn't have the answers. I can suss people out. I can tell that people are genuine when I'm talking to them. And so that, it has multiple benefits. It helps with that, and it also is just good to get to know people. It's a community shop, and we're based around the idea of community. So getting to know people, getting to know how they are, and then when they come in the next week, I can say, oh, how are you doing? How was this or that or whatever we've talked about? It builds a nice community relationship there, I think.
Now, the great thing about The Nest is that you don't have to have a great deal of money in your purse or in your wallet, because you have a very unusual pricing structure. Explain that to me.
Yeah, we do. We've only got two pricing options. We have either you can pay £3.50 for 10 items, and that includes fridge stuff, freezer stuff, all kinds of food, and obviously you also get the fruit, veg and bread on top of that, as I explained earlier. You can either pay £3.50 for those 10 items or £5 for 15 items.
I noticed that actually 18 eggs counted as one item.
Yeah, you'll find all sorts of little bargains like that. You definitely, our aim is that the pricing is around a third of supermarket prices. So that's that can be a big saving. Obviously the bigger households, the £5 option is open to the bigger households who could benefit from a few more items.
Now, I noticed that you were selling Fray Bentos steak and kidney pies, but you can't say, whoopee, I'll take three. You can only take one, is that correct?
That is correct. Some of the items that either have a higher price or are more popular, we limit them to one per customer per week, just to make sure that they're spread fairly. We want to make sure anybody who comes in gets as much food as they can, and we therefore don't want somebody coming in at the start of the week, taking advantage, getting all of one item, selling it on or giving it away themselves. So that's just a nice way of making sure that everybody gets a good share of the food.
Now, you've got a freezer cabinet, you've got refrigeration, it all looks very, very professional. But the thing is, a family could feed itself, couldn't it, from all the product you have on the shelves?
They could. We can't promise that every week, with the extras included, you can get, with your 15 items plus all the extras, you can definitely go a long way to feeding yourself. There's some items we just don't have because our supply is not consistent, because some of the food is surplus food that's been redistributed. We don't order specific items in, we just get given a quantity of food and we don't know what's showing up every week. So there is some uncertainty there, but you definitely can go a long way towards feeding your family, and at the very least you can get some essentials and then top up at a normal shop, still saving you a lot of money.
That is a wonderful choice of food, but where does it come from?
Great, yeah, so we have kind of two sources of food. Our first and main source is through a company called Fair Share that you guys might have heard of. It's Marcus Rashford, with his whole Free School Meals thing, has been working with them. They're a great company, and what they do is they redistribute surplus food from across the country. So that, when I say surplus food, that isn't always food that's past its best before date. That's just any food that the supermarkets know they won't be able to use. So this company called Fair Share, they take food from supermarkets all over the country, bring it into a warehouse, and then send it out to organizations like ours for us to pass on. So there is a price for that food, but it's a very reasonable price, and just to cover Fair Share's costs. So a lot of our food comes in that way. We get our big delivery once a week from them, and the other food comes from the local supermarkets. So we pick those up on like an evening or a morning. So we've got Lidl, Aldi, Tesco, Waitrose, all sorts of supermarkets, and they give us the fresh stuff that they couldn't use that day. So let's say Tesco bakes 100 loaves of bread one day and they only sell 80, 20 loaves of bread would go to us. So that's how we can get a lot of our fruit, veg and bread that way, and that's all totally free. We get that every day from them.
Right, I mean, and there are some treats as well, because I noticed there was a super Morrison's chocolate party cake. For how much?
Yeah, so that would just be one of your items, so that would be 35p would be the how much they'd pay for it, but the original price in the shop I think was over £3. We had, interestingly, this is a great one, we had from Waitrose a piece of meat that they couldn't sell that they gave to us that had a retail price of £19.52. So that's not per kilogram, that was just for that piece of meat. I think it was a sirloin steak, and that will have went away as just one item in the shop. So for 35p is how much somebody will have paid for that. So there's all kinds of weird bargains. We can't always promise we'll have that kind of thing, but if you come, you might get some.
Well, I think it sounds absolutely wonderful. Now, tell us exactly where it is, and give me the email address, Facebook, very slowly, because I hope that people will be taking this down.
Great, yeah, so we're based on Abbotsbury Road in the Waverley Community Hub, which used to be a pub, as mentioned earlier. So, yeah, we're based there. There's orange signs outside pointing you around. Our entrance is around the back. And the way to get in touch, if you'd like to sign up as a member or find out more volunteering options we have all sorts of ways people can either help out or benefit from what we're doing. So we are at The Nest on Facebook. You can message us there. Or you can email us at thenestweymouth@gmail.com, so thenestweymouth@gmail.com. Or you can call or text our phone number, which is 07724 285
851. Eli Holland, thank you very much indeed for talking to Ridgeway Magazine.
And now to Portland once more, and this time taking up the cudgels with Dorset Council Planning Department is the Weymouth Civic Society that has vetoed the plan to allow campervans to park on a beautiful, unspoilt site adjacent to one of the finest views of the Jurassic Coast. John has the story.
I'm talking to Pauline Crump from the Weymouth Civic Society, and Pauline, your organisation is dead against the idea for having a pitch for touring caravans on Portland, and although I've been told that in fact the number of pitches has been reduced from 27 to 20, what is so upsetting about this? Is it the place that they intend to put the pitches?
Yes, exactly. The new ground on Portland is a wonderful place for people to come and spend a short time looking out at the fantastic views. The car parking area is quite rough and ready, but the site that is being identified as a camping pitch for overnight stays is ground where there's wonderful wildlife, beautiful flowers. There's orchids in the spring, late spring anyway, all kinds of flowers, butterflies and things like that. And they're intending to put 20 camper vans, sites for 20 camper vans to stay overnight.
Can I just get the exact location for people who don't know Portland terribly well? Let's take as a kind of focal point the Heights Hotel. Everybody knows where that is. So where is this site in relation to the Heights Hotel?
Well, as you drive onto Portland, there's the roundabout with the Heights Hotel in front of you. And if you go off to the left, there's a road which on the left-hand side, you've got the car parking spaces.
A wonderful view.
Absolutely incredible view of Lyme Bay and the and Chesil Beach and over across Portland Harbour and towards Weymouth. On the other side of the road, the right-hand side of the road, there are open wild grassland meadows. They're not fenced in. They are it's rough grass. I think it's probably used for occasional grazing, although I'm not sure. But those meadows in springtime are full of flowers, and to put camping sites onto them is a dreadful idea.
Okay, so I now know exactly where we're talking about. Yes, you're right. I mean, what's wrong with a flat piece of ground, for goodness sake? I mean, I don't understand why it is that campervans... The popular convention is that campervans are not permitted to stay overnight on Portland. At least that's my belief. Now, of course, one of the problems with campervans is that they're a bit like mushrooms. They sort of grow, don't they? And once one area is turned over to campervans, it's not long before they find other places to stay overnight. So is this sort of the thin end of the wedge for Portland, do you think?
Yes. The problem is, of course, that with campervans or caravans or camping, it's not just the fact that someone is there overnight. It's what they bring with them and what they potentially don't take away. There aren't proper facilities up there. You've got a catch-22. If you build proper facilities, you destroy the area. Those facilities are there 365 days a year, whether people are camping or not, and it has become a different place. And, of course, once this permission is given, and it's important to note that a couple of years ago, on the same site, permission was asked for 27 camping places, I think for caravans then, I'm not absolutely certain. And even after the number of sites was reduced to 20, the planning permission was refused, and it was refused again on appeal. Now, it's actually quite difficult to get planning permissions refused. If the planning officers and even more the appeal people are turning them down, there are very good reasons. My understanding is that the same people have applied again, this time saying it's camper vans rather than caravans. But the same issues apply. It's going to be visually incredibly intrusive, whether the camper vans are there or not. There will have to be other facilities. And if the other facilities aren't there, then, well, I'm not going to say what the implications of that are, but I leave it to people's imaginations.
Well, it's going to be litter. There's got to be some...
Worse than litter.
Well, yes, there's got to be some method of litter collection, places to put your litter, and, of course, not to be indelicate, not every camper van has a toilet.
Exactly. This is not just people who've got sort of a nice outlook wanting to protect things for themselves. This is protecting things for future generations. If we allow this sort of thing on sites like that, it's very difficult to prevent it spreading from the north end of Portland overlooking Weymouth down to the south end at the Bill.
Now, do we know who owns the land and who is behind this application? Somebody must be.
I don't know, but of course the people who make the application have to identify themselves on the application, and that is available on the Dorset Council website. If you look up planning, you should be able. It's not that easy to find the way through the website to the applications, but it is there.
It almost seems to me, as a veteran looker in on Dorset Council websites, that in fact they are made deliberately difficult for people to find out the information that they require.
I wouldn't go that far, but they are difficult to use.
Oh, I think I'm allowed a personal view.
Now, our tame vet, Malcolm Welshman, is here to talk about a memorable Christmas Day and not being too kind to our pets at Christmas time. So Malcolm Welshman is with us, and he's going to tell us all in a Christmas Day's work. What's it all about?
Well, John, it was one particular Christmas which stands out as being quite a hectic one, and of course I was on duty. And it was a phone ringing at 6 o'clock that Christmas morning set it off. The voice at the end of the phone was apologetic. "It's Mrs. Cummings here." I blinked awake. "My Cindy," Mrs. Cummings continued. "She's had 9 puppies already, but I think there's another one. She's been straining for over 2 hours now and nothing's happened. You did say..." I can remember the previous evening's consultation. Mrs. Cummings had brought in her 3-year-old golden retriever, very pregnant and 2 days overdue. Cindy stood patiently while I examined her. There was a 1 degree drop in her temperature and milk was dripping from her teats. "She's about to go into labour," I told Mrs. Cummings. "Looks as if I might be in for quite a Christmas Day then," she replied, smiling ruefully. I nodded. That could apply to me as well, I thought at the time. I carefully explained what danger signs to look out for such as any unproductive straining, hence this early morning call now. "I'll be right over," I said, replacing the receiver with a click. I shivered as I let myself out. The glitter of frost was everywhere, the moon still a scythe of silver in an indigo sky, the car wrapped in ice. Peering through a halo of white, I made the journey over to Mrs. Cummings' address with only 2 skids on the way. "So good of you to come," she said, hurrying out to meet me at the gate, her breath a mist hanging in the air. Together we crunched across to the garage. Inside, snug in a homemade whelping box, warmed by an infrared lamp, lay Cindy. Alongside her, 9 puppies nuzzled for milk. Cindy, exhausted by all her efforts, barely raised her head at my approach. Another contraction had started. "They're not as strong as they were," said Mrs. Cummings. I crouched down, opened my black bag, slipped on a lubricated plastic glove, and carried out an internal examination. I could feel thighs, a tail, so yep, there was a puppy there, but it was back to front, legs tucked up. I sighed. "I'm afraid it's a breach," I said, getting to my feet. Time was now an important factor. The pup's water bag hadn't burst yet, so it was likely to still be alive. I phoned the night nurse at the animal hospital and asked her to get things ready in case I needed to carry out a cesarean. When I got to the hospital, it was a blaze of lights. The nurse was at the door as I drew up, and between us we eased Cindy in, allowing her to plod the last few yards to the operating theatre. There, as we hoisted her up onto the table, I noticed the water bag had actually broken. I decided to have one last examination and touched on 2 legs, both bat legs. "Ah," I decided, grasping the paw in a pair of whelping forceps and gently tugging, "we might just be lucky." As I said that, out popped the puppy. "Well done, Cindy," she wagged her tail and licked her newborn. It was the car journey that had caused the puppy to change its position, allowing the bat legs to extend and enabled me to extract it without the need for a cesarean. Being Christmas, we had tried to send home as many patients as possible, so as not to leave too many in the ward. There was Samantha, a rather obese tabby, recovering from severe gastritis, the result of scoffing a large plateful of giblets. In the next kennel to her was an aged Pekingese who huffed and puffed at me. She was nearly 14, arthritic and suffering from a bad heart. Last Christmas, the arrival of all the family had just been too much for the old girl and she had collapsed. Fortunately, a spot of brandy and prompt veterinary treatment had revived her. but to avoid undue stress this Christmas, her owners had asked her to be hospitalised. "Never mind, Ming," I said, giving her a pat. "You've got a couple of Christmas presents." I unwrapped a rubber bone and a tin of salmon. She gave the bone a derisory snort, but sniffed the tin with great interest. Back home, lunchtime passed peacefully. The Christmas turkey tackled with great gusto. No interruptions. I settled down to watch the Queen's speech, but she scarcely uttered two words before she was drowned by the phone's persistent clamour yet again. "Some people have no respect," I muttered as I answered it. "Yes?" "Sorry to trouble you," the woman at the other end of the line yelled, her voice fading and booming in a pulsating rhythm with background hisses worthy of a basket full of cobras. I flinched, yanking the receiver away from my ear. "Can you hear me?" the woman shouted. Yes, all too clearly. "Well, it's my Fred." "Yes?" "He's just had his Christmas lunch." The voice was suddenly drowned by a cacophony of hisses. "Sorry, what did you say?" "Turkey, stuffing and three roast potatoes." The woman elaborated. The meal was eaten by Fred, her basset hound, an hour ago. Now he'd collapsed and seemed all bloated. "Bring him in straight away," I instructed. Fred arrived prostrate, his breathing rapid, his abdomen grossly swollen. "His stomach has filled with gas," I explained to a trembling, very agitated Mr. and Mrs. Tompkins. "It's pressing on his diaphragm. That's why he's having trouble breathing. We're going to have to operate, and quickly." This was indeed an emergency. Fred was rapidly anaesthetised with an intravenous injection. A nick was made in his side, and a hollow tube inserted through into his stomach. There was a loud shoo as the trapped gas escaped. I attempted to pass a stomach tube, but it jammed due to Fred's stomach having twisted on its axis. So, as feared, I did actually have to open up Fred and manually reposition his stomach into its normal position. He was lucky. Often such cases of gastric torsion cause such a shock to the system that a dog can actually die within hours. I watched the nurse make Fred comfortable in the recovery kennel. "Sorry, matey, it's fluid rations only for the next couple of days." I also felt the need for fluid rations on that day by the time I left the hospital that evening. As I passed through reception, I spotted a bottle of whiskey standing on the counter. A Christmas tag was looped round its neck. It read, "From Cindy Cummings and all her brood. Many thanks. P.S. We're calling that last puppy Noel." "Here's cheers to you all," I whispered, picking up the bottle and closing the door on one Christmas I'll never forget.
We've been talking about Christmas. Now, it's time for treats for everybody, but it is dangerous, isn't it, to give some sort of treats to your pets?
Well, absolutely, John. The big thing is you're having a nice meal. You think your pet should have similar, or at least a part of it. But just bear in mind, it's a change in diet. So there's lots of gravy, lots of bits of fat from the turkey. That can give a digestive upset to your dog and indeed your cat. And the other thing is bones. Turkey bones or whatever you're having are really a no-no for your pet, because if they've been cooked, they crunch up those bones, those become slithers inside their tummy and cause actually quite a bad gastric problem, and also they can pass on down and then cause impaction. Sounds really gloomy. It's supposed to be full of Christmas spirit here, aren't we? And the other thing to bear in mind is all those boxes of chocolates and things. Slipping one, good old Auntie Edna thinking, "Oh, look at those lovely brown eyes of your dog begging beside me," slipping him a chocolate. Could be lethal. They've got theobromide in them, which aren't good for dogs and indeed cats. So no chocolates of that sort. If you do want to give treats, get them from a pet shop so they're guaranteed they're going to be okay. Bones wise, chew bones or something, or even you could on occasions give a bone which has not been cooked. If you see the dog starting to chew the bone away, take it away, and hopefully then you and your pets will have a really enjoyable Christmas.
Thank you very much, Malcolm. Good advice. Since recording this item, we hear Malcolm is in hospital. So, from all of us at Keep 106, get better soon, and we look forward to having you back in the studio with more of your stories when you're better.
Yes, indeed. Now, finally today, much of southern Dorset is in a hard water area, which can play havoc with household appliances, as we all know. So, with slices of lemon and a bottle of white vinegar, here are some ways of removing limescale, all of which our domestic goddess Frances has tried and can vouch for with advice from Wessex Water.
If you look inside your kettle and you see that it's got a load of white stuff inside that isn't actually water, then that's usually limescale. And one of the ways of cleaning it is to squeeze the juice of a lemon into the kettle and then chop up the lemon into small chunks and put those in as well. Then you fill the kettle with enough water to cover the chunks of lemon, boil the water, and then leave it to cool down for a few hours. Once it's cooled, pour away the water and don't forget to remove the lemon chunks before wiping the inside of the kettle with a soft sponge. And you'll find that that does the trick because it always works for me. Now, as far as washing machines, spray the rubber gasket and detergent drawer, make sure you've opened the drawer first, with white vinegar, and then wipe them thoroughly with a microfiber cloth. Then pour 2 cups of white vinegar into the detergent drawer and run the machine on the highest cycle at the hottest possible temperature. And then once the cycle is complete, pour 1/2 cup of baking soda into the drum and repeat the same cycle on the hottest setting. Once finished, wipe down the drum, gasket and drawer with a damp cloth one final time to remove any loose bits of limescale. Now, as far as taps are concerned, it's the sort of thing that you don't really notice hugely, but they are very important to keep clean. So cut a lemon in half and rub it over the taps, making sure you avoid getting any juice inside the tap to prevent contamination. But for extra stubborn bits of limescale, and we've all had them, we know what they're like, soak a cloth in white vinegar and place it over the affected area, leaving it to soak for an hour, and once done, wipe clean with a damp cloth. Now, shower heads. We all know that when the water's coming out, if it comes out more and more slowly, that you've got clogs up it. So therefore, you pour white vinegar into a plastic bag and cover the shower head with the bag, making sure the areas with limescale are submerged in the vinegar. Tie the bag in place with an elastic band. Then leave it for 4 to 5 hours before removing the bag and scrubbing the shower head with a brush to catch any leftover bits of limescale.
Well, I shall be doing that in a few minutes' time when I get home, John.
Oh, I don't believe you.
That's it for today, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for listening from John and me. Goodbye for now. Goodbye. Goodbye.